everyone. It's Greg Gutfeld. This is The One. Let's get right to it because I love this man. His name is Rob Long. He's a writer and co-executive producer of the TV series Kevin Can Wait. But he was also one of the guys behind the classic TV show Cheers. Remember that one? Took place in a bar. He's the author of Conversations with My Agent. That's a book. Set Up, Joke, another book from 2005. He wrote a little book called Bigly, Donald Trump in Verse, came out last year. He's also a contributing editor to National Review, and he hosts a syndicated radio show called Martini Shot. He's also a founder of the website Ricochet.com and writes for the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, and he's been nominated for an Emmy and a Golden Globe, though I'm not sure he won. Did you win?
Why do you do this? The Golden Globe, yes. The Emmy, we were robbed. There's still a lot of questions about the balloting, et cetera, et cetera. Politically correct atmosphere.
Yes.
It's
because you're a conservative. That's why.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't get enough awards. That's the problem.
Exactly. Hey, I have a lot of questions for you. First off, I'm curious how you got to where you are and what your background was and how you ended up doing what you're doing. Is that too broad of a question?
That's about as broad as it gets.
How I ended up,
it helps to have I had two lucky breaks, mm-hmm. or three really. One lucky break, which didn't seem lucky at the time but was in fact lucky, was that I have no marketable skills.
Yes.
Or I had none when I was graduating from college.
Mm-hmm.
And that what I wanted to be was an investment banker because that seemed like a cool job, because all my friends who were investment bankers at the time, they seemed to ride around in limos and, they were the PG-13 version of Christian Bale in American Psycho, which seems, when you really get down to it, except for the serial killing, seems kind of fun.
You know, that's true. When I was this is exactly what I went through, but I didn't go your direction. I'm sorry. Continue, my friend.
Well, I was going to say, it just seemed like really glamorous, and you get to fly around and everything, and wear a suit. Like, the outfits are really cool.
Yeah.
But I just didn't have any aptitude for it at all, and so I sort of took a year after college and kind of was planning to sort of goof around, and then the '87 crash happened, Black Friday in October, and then that sort of took that. That was sort of a lucky break for me because it meant you can't do that.
Right.
And then so I went, maybe I'll go to film school. Mm. And I drove out to L.A. and went to UCLA Film School right when that was sort of a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning of this insane explosion of television comedy, when television comedy, after 4 years or at that point five years of The Cosby Show, had come roaring back.
Mm-hmm.
There was a drought and it came roaring back, and everybody needed people who could write funny stuff, and I was in the right place at the right time, and before I knew it, I was 24 years old. I was a staff writer on Cheers.
So this is incredible. Now, you were a regular Red Eye guest, and you've been on the Greg Gutfeld Show, named after me. I never ask you, but I always never ask you about Cheers because I figure that's such the obvious go-to background peg with you. That
it's also so long ago.
But I mean, I never have ever asked you about it. But I'm really curious, and I think, okay, you're on my podcast. It's one of the greatest shows of all time.
Yes.
What do you remember most about it?
Well, I think what I remember first of all, I remember the first day was this weird out-of-body experience where suddenly you're. Which happens a lot in L.A. or in show business. Suddenly you walk into a room and the people in the room are people that you've known for a long time, but you've never met.
Right.
And they're there. And they are real. And they are actually real people. And they're sitting around eating a tuna sandwich. And then the second thing you learn is that this is an old system and old show business rules. And the writer was the king. And so nobody looked at me and said, what are you, 12?
Yeah.
Get out of here. They looked at me and said, I remember my first week or second week, we shot a play in front of an audience on Tuesday nights, and Tuesday afternoon they would do a little last-minute dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
And the actors would walk through it a little bit, but it was really for cameras and stuff. And then after every scene, the director would say, hey, cast to the rail, and the cast would come walking up to – we would be in the audience seats for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Ordinarily, we just would stand on the stage. And they would come to the rail, and then we would give them notes.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, I was 24, saying to the director, who was my boss at the time, it was like, this is still now a legendary director, Jimmy Burrows.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Jimmy, Ted looked at his watch in run-through at that one part, and he didn't look at his watch here. And I said it like I was concerned.
Yes.
And Jimmy looked at me and said, tell him. Like, why are you telling me? Like, what am I, your messenger boy? And then so suddenly Ted was there, and he said, what? And I was like, you looked at your watch on Thursday. You looked at your watch. It was really funny. And he goes, oh, yeah, when I do the thing? Yeah, when I pull the phone up? Yeah, okay, yeah, got it. And he walked away, and I thought, that was weird. Like, I would have said to me, shut up, kid. You don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
But instead, like the system there was like, we're all working here together, and you contributed this week by telling me to look at my watch like I did on Thursday,
mm-hmm.
and that was enough. And
he seems like a good guy.
Discover that's the system. Oh, he's the nicest. I mean, the entire cast was like they were genial and fun and friendly and
can I ask?
By the time I showed up, they had been working together for a long time, yeah. And they had a shorthand, and they just wanted it to be funny and to make sense. And
can I ask
Ted
you
was,
though a
yeah,
question?
Ted,
like,
yeah.
You would never dish dirt on those members, but was there ever a guest star or somebody that you had that just was like when they were on, everybody was like, oh my god, I can't stand this person.
Yeah, there was a series regular who nobody really liked.
Male or female?
Female.
Oh, yes. Okay, never mind. I already know that. God, that was obvious.
Wait, who are you thinking?
I was thinking of Shelley Long.
Oh, yeah. Well, Shelley, I wasn't there for that. She
Kirstie Alley?
There was just no, they loved Kirstie. I mean, it was more like with Shelley, I think it was.
Was it the woman who played Kelsey Grammer's wife?
I'm not at liberty.
Her what's her name? She played a psychologist. Darn it!
I don't recall.
But it's her. I love Kelsey Grammer.
He's the best.
Yeah, I've met him a couple of times.
Kelsey was a super trained actor.
Yes.
So you could tell Kelsey, in rehearsal on the Friday run through when you did that line, you were like 1/8 angrier.
Yeah.
And could you do it again? He goes, yeah, like this. And you do 1/8 angrier. And they're like, maybe you were like 1/8 angrier at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, well, how about this? And he would do it, and he'd be 1/8 angrier at himself. And then you go, that's perfect. And he would just stick with that. Like he was like he was so disciplined.
He was my favorite.
That he could,
on the show.
Just, I love him. I mean, we still see him when he's in New York, and he's just the greatest. And he was the guy. He just wanted to be good. He just wanted to be funny.
Yeah.
And he would say, I don't know, am I doing this funny? How do I do this? And then you never want to give an actor, certainly like of that stature, a line reading, and he'd finally look at you like, tell me how to say it.
Can I just – I have a couple other questions about the writing process. But, you know, when I think about the character Frasier in the TV show, how important is it about the setting that creates comfort? Like when you watch Cheers, maybe the writing – maybe on a show didn't have to be as strong every week because the setting was so strong. And I felt that way about Frasier. When I watched Frasier, I always felt like I was putting on a sweater and it was comfortable.
Yeah.
And with Cheers
– Yeah,
it was raining, and it was something that made you feel warm. And when you put on Cheers, you actually did feel like you were with these people. I'd say that Friends was almost like that, but not really. I think that Cheers was like you felt that you were with these people. And it was about the bar, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Friends tried that, and I think a lot of it was Jimmy, who also was the director, the series director for Friends.
I didn't know that.
Who created that kind of that camaraderie so that you really felt like you were – part of that, like you were sitting on the other side of them in that coffee shop.
Right.
And that was the feeling. The only thing I think that helped Cheers over create that atmosphere just that was physical was that the bar was so big and people were walking back and forth.
Yes.
And, you know, we could bring somebody, we have somebody who would come in one shot, they would come down the stairs in the front door, walk across the bar, and then disappear into the office or into the pool room.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would just bring them in one shot, and it just felt like you were there, or if not there at that bar, that you were watching this play.
You know,
were in the room with you. You know,
and also, and this is a quirky thing that happens to somebody who watches the show. When you go into the back room, that offers some kind of strange other thing. Like, you know, whenever Sam was in the back room and had to talk to Kirstie Alley or
Dutch,
it was like finding an extra room in your house or something. It's a very interesting. I guess this leads me to my next question. But the psychodynamics and how you create this is so. I'm so interested in it because I'm unable to do it. I mean, like I've written everything. I've done books, nonfiction, TV segments, poems. I wrote a play. I wrote magazine. I wrote 1,000.
I insist on reading the poems.
Oh my God! I published poems. I did a music video for a Russian pop star. I wrote that, which was pretty big. I've done.
Yeah.
I've done a lot, but the thing is, I've also written. 3 full screenplays. I wrote a Married with Children script when I was 24 years old, which was returned to me unopened.
Sure.
And I now understand that if they had opened it and it was similar, and by the way, it was a good script. Yeah. But the thing is, I don't trust my voice when I write any kind of fiction. I can't even take it seriously, and I can't – even when I name characters, like when I'm writing – I'll tell you about some of the scripts I've written which I think are awful. But a lot of it has to – I can't even take the names I give them seriously. Is that normal?
I don't know if it's normal, but I get it. It's like a – I mean, nothing is – well, you know, everything's normal and nothing's normal. But I would say like I get it. I think the difference is that – for one thing, we were doing a show that existed, writing characters that existed.
Yeah.
And so we would write it, and we would think really hard about the scripts, and we'd try to write great dialogue. But the truth is that we were writing it at the service of these characters and these actors, so we were workshopping it all week.
Gotcha.
So by the time we rolled film, it felt like I always tell people like the process was that we would have a table reading on Wednesday mornings. That was when our production week would basically start on Wednesday, and it would go to the following week, and we'd shoot it Tuesday night. So on Wednesday, the script that was read at the table by the actors was like written. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was written because it came from the writers, and the writers wrote dialogue that was written. And if you read that script, it made sense. You could read it, and you knew what was going on. But if you were to read the shooting draft for the Tuesday night, we printed that up, it would feel like almost incomprehensible, like weirdly brittle dialogue, very short sentences, because the actors were acting at that point and they were doing stuff and they were looking a certain way, and we didn't need all the writing that we had written to launch the episode in production. We could take stuff away,
right?
And then some stuff was just funny because of the way they said it, and it's not funny on the page. Whereas on Wednesday morning when we read it around the table, the jokes were all kind of constructed. I think the thing about it is that you have to – I feel like if you are a kind of a person who's self-conscious or easily embarrassed or at all, you have that kind of slight sense that what you're writing isn't the greatest and you're staring at a screen.
Yeah.
I think you can get that weird self-conscious like feedback loop, which is not what you want. I mean,
yeah. I don't have it though. I can sit down and write anything, but it's like I don't take myself seriously when I'm and it's weird because when I wrote for the Huffington Post, all of that stuff was parody and satire.
Yeah.
It was and I was taking real people and making them fictional. But I think I have to figure out a way before I die of how can I change the lens of which I look at this stuff so that I can – it should be as effortless for me as it – well, nothing's effortless, but as I should be competent at this.
Here's what I would suggest. One, that when you were doing that stuff for Huffington Post especially, right, that you were away – there are two people in the room, right? There was you, and then there was the audience that you were writing, and or two audiences. One was, the people who were in on the joke, but basically it was to scandalize everybody else.
Yes.
And so you were writing that, and that was what was fun. Was in your head, what was fun was that you knew that people were going to read this and be scandalized, and they were going to like flip out. And that I think is really. Like that is the relationship you kind of want. Mm-hmm. But when you're writing dialogue, you're writing characters, like it isn't – so the audience is like the other thing you think about. The primary thing you think about is what the character's saying to each other.
Right.
So it isn't so much that you take yourself seriously. It's whether you take them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
that's usually the trick when you're writing comic dialogue between characters.
Do you think that, you know, there's been a few articles on, like, by our new our new religious factions, the social justice sect, that Friends,
sure,
like Friends, could not exist now. Do you? When I mentioned Married with Children, I realized I don't really see Married with Children reruns anywhere. You know that? I mean, are they?
That's true.
Have they decided, like, when networks buy these things because they know they make money? There's like 16 Friends episodes in a row, and they just plow through the Seinfeld in the evening. It's for a reason that Married with Children isn't there. You know?
Well, I think it may just be taking a little break sometimes. I mean, yeah. Married with Children did syndicate. They may have a hard time selling it now.
That's what I'm thinking.
But usually they take these things and put them on the shelf and let them just kind of stew and ferment for a bit and then bring them back out when everybody's forgotten them. But Married with Children was in deep, deep, deep constant rotation for a long time. So I don't know about that, but I think what does happen is once you decide that the most important thing is you're teaching the audience a lesson, you know, laughing is not right. It has to be the right kind of laughing.
Right.
Everything gets – what's the word? Problematic. Everything gets troubling.
That's your new series, Problematic.
Problematic, yeah. So it's just like, well...
You're about to make a joke.
It's funny, but is it the right kind of funny?
Yes.
You know, I don't know the difference, but yeah.
Hey, where's Kevin Can Wait filmed? Is that on the East Coast? Am I stupid?
We shoot it, yeah. I'm talking to you from our studio on Long Island.
Are you the only show that does that? I've never heard of that. Like
we are the only show this far out, but there's a bunch of shows, not like multicam comedy shows.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally there'll be one in New York that's like Spin City and Cosby, both Cosby,
right,
and a few other ones were done. And the Murphy Brown is coming back,
yes,
in the fall, and that will be shot.
They got to bring Dan Quayle on. That's the first episode, right?
Oh, that'd be good. That'd be smart.
Yeah,
in fact,
I think even what's her face? What's her name? Candace
Diane
Bergen.
English? Oh, Candace Bergen. Yeah,
she said that she regrets, or she doesn't regret, but she believes that Dan Quayle was right in the long term. So that would be great to have him. You know what would be great? He plays her second or third husband.
Well, you know, she had a kid, right? So the kid's now got to be grown up.
Ah, jeez.
You got to cast her daughter now.
I don't know if I really like that show. They were all just a little bit too clever and smart for me. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it was, but it shows you what's it shows you the problem now, like how incredibly competitive it is in the environment today. But it always, to me, it feels like, a shareholder of these big media companies, I would wonder why I'm paying the development people so much money, because they're just going back to do the stuff that they did before. So why don't they, you know, why do I need you? Let's just bring these other things back.
Yeah, bring back. By the way, I love that you just said development, because I have a number of ideas that I'm going to pitch to you quickly. And I want you just to, like, you know, be honest. Right. Tell me what you think. Okay, so first, my first sitcom idea, it's about a handsome doctor. So that's all I have right now.
That's great. I love it.
Okay, so I think we could probably flesh that one out. Then I have this one. An unmarried female lawyer in her early 30s. But the twist is she's psychic.
Love it.
Yeah,
love
I think it. That's got sell all over it. Then
I also don't feel like that's probably more of a dramedy.
Yes. I by the way, I'm very confused by that word, because I don't know if it should be dramedy or dramedy.
A dramedy. Well, the dramedies are usually more funny, and dramedies are more drama.
How about a science fiction comedy called A Dramedy Strain?
Yeah, I don't. That's a hard pass on that one. They can't all be home runs.
Yeah, but you know what? That's a great. Michael Crichton somewhere is smiling. You know. Anyway.
Yes, he should be.
He should be. He was an amazing boy, man. That dude.
Was he incredible?
That dude is the stuff he put out. Westworld. Westworld, one of my favorite movies of all time. And I did love Andromeda Strain. There was what was the one about the people in a coma? Well, I was going to say, what was the movie about people in a coma? It's called Coma. A movie. Every movie he did, amazing. By the way, here's another pitch. An animated comedy about farmers, and I call it Wiseacres. It's like Family Guy with pitchforks. Okay, see, I know how to pitch. How about this?
Yeah, that's right.
Here's another. An hour show. The setting is a big city police department. Okay, so whatever you think, where do you go with that?
Well, you go to Barney Miller with it.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not trying to take away from your originality, but that's Barney Miller you just pitched. It was a really good show.
It was a great show. And by the way, the best thing about the show, the damn theme. That theme, when they go out, when the guitar solo, and it's boom, boot. It starts with the bass, and then it's such a great theme. And then, by the way, I just saw Max Gale on a soap opera. He plays like the crazy grandfather, I think.
Wow.
Max Gale. It makes us old.
That's another show that would be really – the way it was done and the characters on it would be really problematic now. They were like local village residents. You know, they were always busting the gay guy.
You know what you're talking about? I was just going to get there. How they portrayed the gay – I don't know if you'd call them the perps or the – because they were not – like they would – some they would be arrested for solicitation. Others would be victims of crimes. But they did that 70s stereotype that you saw like in Cruising – the movie with – oh, God, I can't remember that movie. Forget it. Where if you were gay, you had a scarf. Remember? You always wore a scarf.
A scarf and a kind of a purse.
And a purse.
And a weird vest.
And you had – and there was only three or four actors that could play that. And the one of them was in Barney Miller. He was the go-to gay man. And
which
he
is
was
gay, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just – and they just – it's so interesting now how that was – that was handled without ever saying anything, and like everybody would just when they'd be on the set, the other cops would kind of smile and roll their eyes, and not really say anything. I have another idea. Now, you're gonna love this one. It's totally original. This show is totally original. It's called Shears. So it's a barber shop. Let's say it's a barber shop in Boston. And it's run by a bald guy. So the bald guy runs Shears. Do you see the irony? It'd be like a guy who can't drink running a bar. Anyway, and he interacts with regulars and that come to the barbershop. And there's this romance sexual tension between the barber, the head barber, and
the old school guy. And the new young – yeah.
Yeah, okay. But there's like a hair salon next door. And the girl's like really spunky and – doesn't like his riffraff, and they end up, and it takes a while, like maybe one or two seasons before they finally hook up. Shears.
Yeah.
No?
I got to pass on that one, too. I mean, just going to be super honest with you. I'm just going to pass on that one. And here's why, because it's like I'm just watching into my head, and there's hair on the floor. You know what I mean?
Yeah, nobody likes hair on the floor.
No, they even creeps me out of the barbershop. I don't like the fact that my hair sometimes falls off and lands on someone else's hair, even though I know it's no longer on my head.
That is so true. Oh, my God.
It's weird.
It's
yeah.
disgusting. It's very intimate that your hair is mixing with other hair.
But you know what? All mixed up together.
It's like mortality. It's like you're in the ground mixing with other bodies. I have one more.
wow.
Yes, one more. It's a serious one-hour drama. The title is This Is Who We Are Today, comma, Now. I see this as like a Ken Olin-produced thing.
Yes.
Do you have his number that you could give me just over the podcast?
I have his number, but I can't give it to you. I have to answer that
question. So This Is Who We Are Today, Now. Ensemble cast, like an extended family of time travelers. Time travelers, Rob.
You bury the lead. That's how you start. and they're going back, but can they go back and forth to their own lives?
Yes, they go back and forth, and they try to help themselves out, but it always creates more problems for their future selves.
Right, there you go. And nobody's getting rich. That's the rule. Like the thing is, with time travel, you have to come up with a reason why.
Yes,
you're not
at the racetrack.
Just getting rich.
Yes. Why aren't you buying stock? If the time travel of a movie has to be you're at the racetrack in the morning. No, you're buying stock the night before.
Yeah.
And then you're going to the racetrack in the morning, and that's all you do.
Then maybe if you have time, you'll go back and kill Hitler. But
yes,
you know, let's get rich first.
Yeah, that's the has there been – well, Back to the Future. Wasn't there the guy who got the book? Didn't he try to get the book? Oh, God. The book of the Sports Almanac, right? And he started betting.
Oh, right. Right, right, right. That was the guy, Biff.
Yeah, Biff, or our President Trump, as people like to call him. That was unfair. Anyway, I want to let you go because it's now almost 3:30. You gave me a half an hour of your time. It's always
I got all day.
All right,
you tell me. Are you more to pitch? I mean, I'm here to. None of these except the ones I passed on seem outrightly like they're not going to work. I'd like to have a piece of all of them, just a small piece.
Do you know that I wrote scripts. When I was in my 20s, I submitted one to a film contest. I never heard back. And I quit my job from the American Spectator to go to write, but I ended up taking a magazine job because I just didn't have the confidence in the stuff. So now that's the one thing left I want to do. And also, I've talked to a lot of script writers about this, and they give me books, but I'm going to do it when I'm.
Yeah, books are dumb.
Book. Yeah, I don't feel like.
But what are you trying to write, a movie?
I wrote a movie a couple years ago. Got halfway through it because I didn't know how to end it, and also I got bogged down in work. You know, you could always find an excuse I didn't think it through.
Yeah, but here's the thing: they don't make movies anymore like that.
Yeah.
So you could write a great movie, and they'll be like, "Oh, that's really great." We don't make them.
Yeah.
You know, they don't still make them. So instead of writing a movie, write a 10-episode or 24 episode
Black Mirror
TV show.
Well, the thing is,
Black Mirror. Yeah.
I stopped writing at like 35 pages or 40 pages, so maybe I should just
it's 1 hour.
Yeah, just figure that out. And like, I look at Black Mirror and I go, "This is something that I would love to do." I think that it's hit or miss on Black Mirror, but when it hits, it's really good. And then,
when it hits, it somehow when it hits, it's like a Twilight Zone great.
Oh my God!
Like,
yeah,
wow, you just kind of tapped into something really real.
Yeah, and there was a I really like Get Shorty. Have you been watching that?
No, but people tell me it's really good.
I saw it on a billboard. And I'm going, oh, here we go again. To your point about development, here we go again. Nobody ever does anything original. And then I watched the first two episodes. And I'm going, this is as good as it gets on these kind of. It's like Rockford. It's got a very Rockford Files, Justified feel, and anything that I like Rockford Files because I felt that was kind of
a
very
great
loose.
Show.
Yeah, it just felt so good, and James Garner was amazing. Get Shorty. I was so surprised how engaging and smart, and the characters are. It's James Ellroy. It's who's the writer. Dick.
Is
it James?
Dick. That guy.
The guy wrote Get Shorty.
Yeah, that guy.
His writing, he knows how to write people who aren't evil or good, but right in the middle. He knows how to get that interesting bad guy. And those are the interesting people in the world. What the hell is his name? Not James Ellroy, not Jim Thompson.
Oh, man. Dick,
he wrote. Oh, God.
He wrote Get Shorty, and he wrote a bunch of things, yeah.
Yeah, and he wrote Justified. He wrote – it was called Fire in the Hole. Elmore Leonard. Yeah, that's why
– James, what is his name? Come on.
That's why Justified is so good and Get Shorty is good. There's a comfortable confidence and great these flashes of violence that come when you don't expect it.
Right.
It's so – I really enjoy that. But anyway, I'm going to shut up because I actually have to go – Now do the five. I got to go down and.
I was going to say the five is like that. You are that the five is an ensemble comedy in the afternoon.
It's friends.
Bunch of people. Nobody's friends, but nobody's doing anything. You're just sitting around talking, but that's okay. You have interpersonal. You have closer friendships, and then not so close friendships, and then some hostilities and tensions erupt here and there.
Not as much anymore. Gilligan's Island. Gilligan's Island, right? Isn't that what the five is?
And you are Lovey Howell.
Yes. No, I think Jesse is the professor. Just by looks. I am Gilligan. I'm assuming I'm Gilligan because it's Gilligan's Island, but because I'm the goofy clown. So and then Marianne is Dana, and the movie star is Kimberly Ginger, and then Juan is. I don't know what Juan. This is
I think
where
Juan is the professor.
Juan's the professor. Jesse is the skipper.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, maybe he is.
You're
skipper.
Little buddy.
Yeah, and I'm a little buddy. Yeah, because Jesse is because Jesse delivers the straight ahead. This is what we're going to do. Stuff. I'm the off the side doing something else, and Juan is like, "Wait a second. I'm rational." That's the professor.
here's what you need to do. You light this thing on fire and then create the force. That way, that could work.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That were Gilligan's Island.
Great show.
Because you know, there was never like, we are Gilligan's Island. And you know, when you think about it, I write scripts for that show. I sit and I write stuff and that's what I do. So it's kind of like maybe that's why I'm not doing it, is that I'm already doing it.
I was going to say, you're already writing dialogue for the character that you've created, which is basically you.
That's true. Holy crap!
But a little less you than you, or a little bit more you than you.
That is so.
And you're doing it, and you're interacting.
I got the best thing ever.
Characters.
I'm writing a character that's me. That is like that's an epiphany. You just led me into a world of epiphany.
It's also a problem for your psychiatrist, by the way, that you're writing dialogue for your character played by you. But notice how weird it would be if you went and the characters, all the people around the table, suddenly kind of changed their mind about stuff.
Mm.
Like, wouldn't that be weird? It'd be like, no, you're the professor. Be the professor.
Yes.
And those old sitcoms, they always did one episode where people would like bang their heads together and then they would change personalities.
Right, like Freaky Friday. You know, and I did hit my head. I don't know if you knew that I had a concussion. I should have done that. That would have been a great experiment on the viewer, because I was out for a couple of days. A studio door hit me in the head. I could have done that. I could have returned as like a Michael Moore character, and that would have been great. But we had thought about that.
It wouldn't work. They would have to replace you, because we have our ensemble. We like what we have. We have the chemistry we have. We don't want any more chemistry.
Wouldn't it be great if we pulled like a Brady Bunch and added like a little, what's that kid's name?
The little Oliver.
Added an Oliver at the end of the table. Like just somebody new.
Somebody young and new.
Hey, all right, I got to go. I love talking to you. When are you going to do my show next?
I do it anytime. We're officially on hiatus starting March 9, and I basically have 6 months. I can do anything I want.
Oh, excellent! And probably if Trump does the correspondence dinner, do you remember when you did that show with us? How horrible it was. We had to sit there. It was Obama was, and we were, and our poor audience that was in there was just like so miserable. It was
nothing funny.
I would like to think that whatever happens with Trump, it's not going to be like that, and we're going to have a blast. I'm going to make sure we have booze this time, and that the audience, I will handpick an audience that doesn't mind if they're just sitting around, not never seeing the light of day. So that's what we'll do.
Exactly what you should do. Just get a bartender.
Yeah, get a bartender. Exactly. That's a really good point. Get a bartender, set up a bar. That's why you make the big bucks.
Yeah, that's why. Because I'm always thinking about who's bringing me cocktails.
You know what's great? I just came up with another sitcom idea. It's a guy who's a taxidermist, and he only deals with deer. And the last line is always, "That's why you make the big bucks." I should end the podcast on that.
Yeah, you should end a lot of things on that.
Thank you, Rob.